Chapter 27. J. Edgar Hoover's strong dislike for Dorothy Kilgallen was exacerbated because he and his agents could not discover the mole at the Warren Commission, who had passed along Ruby's testimony to Kilgallen. In effect, the middle-aged female reporter with the high society profile, best known, for God's sakes, as a quiz show panelist and gossip columnist, had made a fool of him. Instead of being in prison, where Hoover believed Kilgallen belonged, she was perceived as a hero of sorts. Instead of ridicule for illegal actions, praise followed her exclusive. One circulated in newspapers not only in the United States, but around the world through the Associated Press. Government officials were so upset, Congress considered an investigation into why Hoover, who had pegged not only Martin Luther King Jr., but also poet Allen Ginsberg as dangerous subversives, permitted the leak. Only Hoover's power prevented this from happening. Hoover's intent to close down any proper investigation comes from the director's actions on November 25, 1963, 3 days after JFK was assassinated, and 1 day after Ruby shot Oswald. First, Hoover ordered the Dallas Police Department to forward all the investigation files to the Bureau in Washington, a decision that infuriated Chief Jesse Curry, according to his aforementioned book. This prevented any further investigation on the DPD's part. Curry was also upset that Captain Will Fritz, described by Curry as one of the most skilled investigators in law enforcement, was prevented from doing his job. Curry wrote, "Because of the pressure from other investigative agencies, Captain Fritz was never allowed to carry out an orderly, private interview with Oswald." Curry added, "The Dallas Homicide Bureau was caught in a politically motivated crossfire from other government agencies. The interrogation was a three-ring circus." Deciding who may have orchestrated the crossfire leads to none other than J. Edgar Hoover. Afraid of what the DPD might uncover, he was covering up the truth within hours of Ruby shooting Oswald. Chief Curry commented, "I have always wondered whether or not Captain Fritz could have obtained crucial information from Oswald if he had been allowed to spend 2 or 3 hours alone with him under normal interrogation conditions." Hoover could not let that happen. From November 29, 1963, just a week to the day after JFK had been assassinated, the FBI director had been on notice that Kilgallen wasn't headed in the Oswald alone direction like everyone else when she wrote, as noted, "The Oswald file must not close" column. So many people are saying there was something queer about the killing of Oswald, something strange about the way his case was handled, a great deal missing in the official account of his crime. The American people have just lost a beloved president. It was a dark chapter in our history. But we have the right to read every word of it. It cannot be kept locked in a file in Dallas. Ending the column, Kilgallen wrote, "Justice is a big rug. When you pull it out from under one man, a lot of others fall too." These strong words must have impacted Hoover, causing him to wonder whether he was the one man Kilgallen referenced. To keep the courageous reporter under close watch, it's quite likely she was under FBI surveillance again. During the early 1950s, more than a decade before the Dallas assassinations, she and Richard discussed Russian movies appearing at a New York theater during their radio program. Richard said that he believed many of the Communist Front organizations were allowed to continue operation so the FBI could root out subversives. He surmised that in about an hour after the communist meetings, the FBI comes in and they pick up every little scrap of paper, cigarette butts, anything that could be used as evidence. Adding her thoughts, Kilgallen told the radio audience, "They probably take little candid snaps. Now they have cameras the size of cigarette lighters. they can take pictures under all circumstances. Such banter caught the attention of an FBI informer, who quickly called bureau agents in the New York office. The informer described the twosome as idiot-type people, and the program as chatter and comments. Immediately, Hoover received a complete transcript of the show under the title, Colmars Tell How FBI Operates at Radical Meetings. Monitoring Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick became a continuing FBI operation. That the FBI continued its surveillance of Kilgallen is evidenced by an FBI memorandum to Hoover, dated September 17, 1959, obtained by this author under the Freedom of Information Act. This was apparently a clandestine operation, since an informant was assigned to infiltrate the lives of both Kilgallen and Richard. Regarding him, the memo stated, Dick Colmar operates the Left Bank restaurant on West 50th Street. The informant advised Kilgallen goes there about once or twice a week, and that Colmar has been dating other women. He has his own private apartment on the third floor of the building. Further, the memo stated, Colmar is or has been interested in both sexes. And Colmar showed interest in the informant. Informant stated that under the pretext of discussing the presentation of her artwork in the Left Bank, he induced her to go to his private rooms at the Left Bank, and there attempted to make intimate advances. Concerning Kilgallen, the memo stated, Dorothy Kilgallen and her husband Richard Colmar have their own private lives, and Kilgallen is active in a group called the Science Club, which meets on Mondays for luncheon at P.J. Clark's bar. The informant has attended several of these meetings. Added was information the informant advised that Miss Kilgallen has been extremely attentive and apparently attracted to the singer Johnny Ray. Continuing to monitor Kilgallen's investigation of the JFK assassination, a September 23, 1964 FBI memo, issued 27 days after Hoover's letter memo to General Counsel Lee Rankin at the Warren Commission on the same subject, secured by this author through the Freedom of Information Act, included several questions about Kilgallen's whereabouts and behavior, and how she ended up with Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission. Joe Tonahill and Melvin Belli are discussed in addition to Kilgallen. Excerpts include whether Tonahill met Dorothy Kilgallen during her stay in Dallas, February to March 1964, during Ruby trial, whether he had known her before, how long, whether he has seen or corresponded with her since, if so, the nature of the conversations and correspondence, whether she solicited him for any documents re Ruby, if so, when, where, and how, and specifically, whether he furnished copy of Ruby interview on June 7, 1964 to her, if so, when, where, and how. Does Tonahill have any info as to who furnished the Ruby Warren Commission info to Kilgallen, if he did not do the same? Whether Tonahill has reproduced any copy from the copy furnished by the commission? If so, why? To whom it was published? When, where, and how did he furnish a copy to Melvin Belli, former defense attorney for Ruby? Does he have any info as to who furnished the material to Kilgallen, if he did not do the same? Based on a bureau memorandum dated September 30, 1964, there is no question that the FBI was continuing its investigation of Kilgallen as Hoover had promised in his August 26th letter memo to Rankin. Agents, according to the memo, were acting in connection with our inquiry regarding Kilgallen, specifically requested by the President's Commission to determine where she obtained the verbatim testimony of Jack Ruby's interview in Dallas. Proof that Kilgallen knew the FBI represented the commission is given with the further post-reading. Kilgallen is fully aware that our inquiry is based on a specific commission request. Instead of cooperating with the FBI, Kilgallen stonewalled them to the point of writing, as noted, on October 4, 1964, I'm inclined to believe that the FBI might be more profitably employed in probing the facts of the case, the JFK assassination, rather than how I got them, which does seem a waste of time to me. When Hoover read this column, entitled, "Maybe You Didn't Know," his face must have turned red with anger, since not only had the journalist called the effort to get her to reveal sources a waste of time, but topped that critical remark by mocking the Bureau while calling on it to uptick its investigation of the JFK assassination, since she apparently felt it was woefully inadequate. To deny the strong impact that Kilgallen's words had is to forget that each column she wrote was read by millions of people across America. Kilgallen had never been afraid to blast those she believed deserved a blasting, including Frank Sinatra, Radio Free Europe, those targeting entertainment figures as communists with no proof, the Shepherd Jury, and numerous others who incurred her wrath. However, this time, she was targeting the nation's police force, the FBI, and its director, one of the most powerful men in the United States. Even President John F. Kennedy and Attorney General Robert Kennedy kneeled at Hoover's feet, since he had so much dirt on the Kennedys, but not Kilgallen, a fearless, brave reporter who was determined to uncover the truth despite Hoover's cover-up aspirations and despite the danger involved. Through any surveillance, recall that she had told author Mark Lane, intelligence agencies will be watching us. We'll have to be very careful, including that of the informant. Hoover and his operatives could have been knowledgeable of Kilgallen's drinking habits, and arguably any drug use as well. Wary of what she might uncover through her continuing investigation, is it plausible to believe that the director, with his reputation at stake, had a hand in Kilgallen's death? Had he assigned rogue agents to the task? And then, had those agents, or perhaps a mole within Kilgallen's camp, made it appear she died accidentally? Under this theory, Hoover prevented the dogged reporter from any opportunity to cause the director damage from her disclosures. The fresh evidence she had uncovered that could destroy his reputation and even topple him from power. If so, seems logical that he was the one who ended up with Kilgallen's assassination file, destroyed at first chance. Evidence that this scenario is plausible is the statement by Brenda DeJordan to this author in June 2017. It recalled her father's description of FBI agents, or those posing as agents, infiltrating Kilgallen's townhouse on November 8, 1965, the day her body was discovered. Among the disclosures, in addition to those presented in this book's introduction, are: Dad was asked to leave the bedroom where Dorothy's body was finally found. He was very upset when they told him not to say anything about Dorothy's death. It scared him. Those present in the townhouse on the day Kilgallen died were my parents, Kilgallen's father Jim, Secretary Myrtle Vern, who was efficient, discreet, and totally dedicated to Dorothy, maid Marie Eichler, and Richard with daughter Jill and Larry Grossman appearing later. My dad said the FBI told him Dorothy died of natural causes, a drug overdose. But my mother and father didn't buy it. Nobody did. They said she was not that kind of a person, with the drugs and all. Dad also said, "If the death is accidental, why are you here?" to the FBI agents. Dad said there were people coming in and taking boxes out. All of Dorothy's papers, things she had, all gone. The family didn't take them. The FBI did. When the FBI took things out, my father asked, "Why are you doing this?" He went at the agents so hard that he was finally told to keep his mouth shut. DeJordan's account obviously complicates the alternate theories as to who murdered Kilgallen. But according to the timelines provided, her body was discovered first by James Clement and later by Mark Sinclair around 9 a.m., so there was plenty of time for the FBI agents to have been at the townhouse before Detective Doyle and Dr. James Luke arrived mid-afternoon. Questions to be asked include: does the appearance of the agents prove Hoover was behind Kilgallen's death? That earlier agents had been complicit in her death? Or, if Hoover was not involved with giving the order to eliminate the star reporter, who definitely knew too much, Had he somehow been informed of her death, and with great swiftness sent his agents to the townhouse? Their mission would have been to confiscate any papers, documents, whatever they could find, thus giving credence to Clement's account that boxes were being taken away, leading to the belief that Hoover could have potentially ended up with a big prize, Kilgallen's JFK assassination file. To date, no official record has surfaced indicating FBI agents were present in the Kilgallen townhouse on the day she died. Regardless, DeJordan's plausible account must be taken into consideration when deciding if J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI finally closed the door on their chief tormentor. Doing so eliminated any potential for a grand jury investigation based on the book she was writing for Random House.